Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Hello and welcome to Reality Check. Today is Tuesday, the 15th of September 2009, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. Is episode 7 of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. Reality Check is a show designed to give you a healthy dose of reality. And we do that by promoting the art of critical thinking and skeptical analysis. Each week we bring you a roundup of LGBT news, followed by an in-depth analysis of an issue related to the paranormal or the pseudoscientific. And finally, we wrap up each show with a movie review. On today's show, after our LGBT news roundup, we'll bring you the fourth and final sizzling installment of our in-depth analysis of the now infamous blood type diet. Then, in our movie review section, we'll review Werner Herzog's latest documentary, Encounters at the End of the World. So stay tuned for all that and more here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9. But before we leap ahead into this week's news, I have a very special announcement to make. Reality Check, the world-famous radio show and podcast, now has its own blog. Yes, indeed, Reality Check has come well and truly into the 21st century. And on the blog, you can do three things. You can listen to any Reality Check episode you want online. You can also download the file of an individual episode to listen to later. And you can even subscribe to the show, so it will automatically download into your podcatcher every week without you even lifting a finger. So where can I find this amazing blog, I hear you ask? Well, I'll tell you. The website address is so easy to remember. It's realitycheckonline.net. That's realitycheckonline.net. So check it out this week, subscribe, and you'll never miss another episode of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. Right, now let's get into our LGBT news for the last week or so. And our two items this week are actually follow-ups of stories previously covered here on Reality Check. First up are developments in Uruguay. We reported 2 weeks ago here in episode 5 that the lower house of Uruguay's Congress had passed a bill that would allow same-sex couples to adopt children. Well, I'm delighted to report this week that last Wednesday, the 9th of September, the Uruguayan Senate also passed that bill. So it has now been handed on to the president, who will sign it into law. Now, I'm not sure exactly when it will come into effect, but presumably sometime in the next few weeks or months. So that's fantastic news there from Uruguay, which now becomes the first country in Latin America to allow adoption of children by same-sex couples. And that's not just adoption by one member of a same-sex couple of the biological children of his or her partner, but that's full adoption rights. That is the right of a same-sex couple to adopt children unrelated to them. So really great news there and a major step forward for LGB equality in Latin America. Now let's move from Uruguay across the Atlantic to the UK, where we reported 3 weeks ago here in episode 4 of Reality Check that a campaign was underway to pressure the British government to issue an official apology to Alan Turing, the mathematician and father of the modern computer, who was convicted of the crime of homosexuality in 1952 and tragically committed suicide soon after. Well, the campaign achieved its goal, and I'm happy to report that last Friday, September the 11th, the British Prime Minister Gordon Brown issued an official apology on behalf of the British government for the way in which Turing was treated after the war. Gordon Brown said, and I quote, "While Mr. Turing was dealt with under the law of the time, and we can't put the clock back, his treatment was, of course, utterly unfair, and I am pleased to have the chance to say how deeply sorry I and we all are for what happened to him." And I have to say that this news story got great coverage all over the world. I heard it mentioned on the local ABC News here in Melbourne and saw it reported in a lot of international newspapers, so that's great. Well, obviously the story is extremely tragic and the apology, well, doesn't do any good for Alan Turing, but I think it does have important symbolic value for the Prime Minister to apologise for unjust acts that were committed by the state in the past. And it's great that it got so much coverage in the mainstream press. Now, some justified criticism has arisen following this apology, particularly voiced by Peter Tatchell, a famous LGBT rights activist in London, originally from Melbourne, actually. And he pointed out that an estimated 100,000 British men were also prosecuted under the same law used against Turing, and that they should also receive an apology. He said, "Singling out Turing just because he is famous is wrong." And I have to say I agree with that. The suffering of those other men was no less than Turing's and no more justified, well, just as unjustified as the prosecution and suffering of Alan Turing. And of course, well, we shouldn't forget that even though this happened 50 years ago in the UK, it is, of course, still happening in many parts of the world. There are still, unfortunately, 85 countries, approximately, where homosexuality is a crime, and 7 where it is actually punishable by death. So, sadly, Turing's tragedy is repeated every day all over the world, still today. Now, last time we talked about Alan Turing, we mentioned the Turing test, but didn't actually describe what it is. So I thought that today would provide the perfect opportunity to tell you what the Turing test actually is. Now, basically, it's a rule of thumb kind of test to determine the moment at which you can say that a computer is intelligent. And the test works like this. You have a human experimenter who engages in normal conversation with another human and a computer, all of them in separate locations. And the conversation is all done by text, so typing on a computer, basically, like chatting in Messenger. So if the experimenter cannot determine which is the human and which is the computer, then that computer is said to have passed the Turing test and can be said to have attained a certain level of intelligence. Turing described this test in a paper published in 1950, and since then it's been a fundamental concept in the philosophy of artificial intelligence. So because we can't really know if computers are thinking, this is one kind of lateral way to approach the question from a slightly different direction, but looking at the same type of question. And I can report that until now, no computer has ever passed the Turing test. But they say it's only a question of time until one eventually does. So that's the Turing test, and that's good news. Finally, to wrap up the very tragic life story of Alan Turing. And that brings us to an end of our news section for today. Let's listen to a song, and when we come back, we'll bring our analysis of the blood type diet to its shattering conclusion. So stay tuned for that after this song here on Joy 94.9.
Over 200 volunteers bring you joy every week. Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. I'm Tony Pittman, and the song you just heard there was Whisper in the Dark by Dionne Warwick from the album Friends, released in 1985. Now we move into the fourth and final chapter of our deep and probing analysis of the science, or lack of it, behind the blood type diet. Now, in case you're tuning into Reality Check for the first time and missed our previous discussions on this topic, don't worry, you can download them all on the new Reality Check website. That's realitycheckonline.net. And if you download episodes 2, 3, and 5, you'll be up to date with everything you need to know about this highly dubious diet. So, a brief recap to refresh the memories of our old listeners. Now, what we're talking about here is the so-called blood type diet, as expounded by Dr. Peter D'Adamo in his best-selling book, Eat Right for Your Type. In a nutshell, Dr. D'Adamo says that our ideal diet should be based on our ABO blood type. So if you're O, you should eat mostly meat. If you're A, mostly grains. If you're B, mostly dairy products. And if you're AB, well, I think it's kind of a mix. Now, in the last two installments, we demonstrated that Dr. D'Adamo's theories are all completely unsound and have no basis in science whatsoever. In other words, your blood type is not a factor at all in determining what your ideal diet should be. What I want to do on the show today is first look at a bit of the real science behind blood type and disease, and secondly, have some fun by pointing out some of the more stupid things that Dr. D'Adamo says in his highly stupid book. So first, let's look a little bit at the real science behind blood type and diseases. So first of all, what exactly are we talking about when we talk about blood type? Well, we've done so much talking about blood types until now, but we've never actually got down to the nitty-gritty of what the ABO blood type really refers to. So what we're talking about is the red blood cells. They're the ones that contain millions of hemoglobin molecules, and their role is to transport oxygen from the lungs to the body's tissues. And specifically, what we're talking about is a protein on the surface of the red blood cells. Well, actually, it's called a glycoprotein. So that's basically a protein with a few sugar rings hanging off it. So one kind of glycoprotein on the cell surface is the kind that determines your ABO blood type. The type A glycoproteins have an extra little sugar ring on top. The type Bs have a slightly different sugar ring, and the type Os have no sugar ring. So it's those sugar rings that act as antigens, that is, they are recognized by the body's immune system and provoke an immune response if they're not what the body expects. And that's why blood cells from people with blood type O can be given to anybody, because they don't have that extra little sugar ring on their surface, so they don't provoke an immune reaction in other humans. Other humans just accept those red blood cells as their own because they don't see that sugar ring to alert them that it's foreign. Now, the ABO glycoproteins are not the only ones on the surface of red blood cells. There are actually scores of other kinds of surface proteins. Therefore, other ways to classify blood types, such as the MNS blood group system, or the Kell system, or the Lewis system. And of course, there is also the rhesus system, which most people know about. This is whether you are rhesus positive or negative. So that's what people talk about when they say, I'm O positive. That means that they have the rhesus protein on the surface of their blood cells to make them positive. So if there are so many proteins on the surface of our red blood cells and so many different groups, blood groups to classify us by, why all this focus on the ABO blood system? Well, the answer is basically because the ABO and the rhesus systems are the most important for doing blood transfusions and also for organ transplants. Those ABO blood groups are the ones that provoke particularly strong responses in the immune system, and so incompatibility in that system can cause serious complications and even death. That's why they're the important ones, the most important ones to know. I should also mention that the presence or absence of that little sugar ring on the surface of the blood cell apparently has no effect on the functioning of the cell. The cell still carries its hemoglobin around the body just as it's supposed to do. Okay, so now that we know exactly what we're talking about, well, more or less, let's look at the real science behind blood type and disease, because it turns out that there is actually a correlation between certain blood types and some diseases. Now, one important fact that would appear to indicate this is the fact that blood type distribution is not uniform across the world. Certain regions have higher incidences of one type or another. For example, blood types B and AB didn't exist amongst Australian Aborigines before the arrival of Europeans. Australian Aborigines were all O or A, that's it. Whereas the Ainu in northern Japan have a very high incidence of blood types B and AB. And you can see these types of variations in populations throughout the world. So this situation appears to have come about as a result of what is called balancing selection. That is, at different times in history, natural selection has favored a certain blood type, or even a combination of blood types, probably because they conferred resistance to diseases that were attacking the population at that time. For example, it appears that people with blood type A may be slightly more susceptible to smallpox, and blood type O people are slightly more prone to get plague and cholera. Yet, at the same time, blood type O people are more resistant to rheumatic fever and possibly syphilis. So when epidemics hit a certain population, they will probably change the ABO gene frequencies in the surviving population. If smallpox hits, it will probably kill a disproportionate number of type A people, whereas if it's bubonic plague that comes along, then the type A's may survive better, and it will be the type O's that are killed in higher numbers. Thus, these arbitrary waves of infectious diseases over time can have a pretty significant impact on the frequencies of the ABO blood types in any given population. For example, India has a relatively high frequency of blood type B, which may be partly due to selection against type A people when smallpox epidemics came around, and type O when bubonic plague came along. But why should viruses or bacteria be slightly more lethal for some blood types and not others? Well, one theory is that the proteins, these glycoproteins on the cell membrane of these microbes, are very similar to the A, B, or O antigens, glycoproteins, on the red blood cells, and therefore the microbes can sometimes escape detection by the host's immune system. Scientists have also found that certain ABO blood types are slightly more susceptible to certain types of cancers. For example, type B has a slightly higher risk of getting pancreatic cancer, whereas type O's have a slightly risk of stomach cancer. So no one knows exactly why, but I have read that it may not necessarily be determined by the blood type itself, but could be a nearby gene on the same chromosome that causes that higher risk. So still an area under a lot of scientific investigation. It is also well documented that people with blood type O have a slightly higher risk of developing stomach ulcers. And the reason for this is because stomach ulcers are caused by Helicobacter pylori, a bacterium with a special affinity, apparently, for the proteins on O red blood cells. So, although Dr. D'Adamo was completely wrong in all his theories about blood type and diet, it turns out that the notion that blood type is related to our susceptibility to certain diseases is one with scientific validity. Of course, this discovery didn't come about in any way due to the amazing insights of Dr. D'Adamo. It came about through real scientists doing real careful scientific research, something I think Dr. D'Adamo wouldn't even recognize if you hit him over the head with it. Okay, let's listen to another song now, and when we come back, we'll get into our final session of our final chapter on the blood type diet, where we have some fun and look at some of the really stupid things that Dr. D'Adamo says in his book. So stay tuned for that here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
You're listening to Joy 94.9. The show is Reality Check, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. And the song you just heard there was Niño by Mexican pop group Bella Nova. And I just want to send a couple of shout-outs. I've just got some SMSs here in the studio, one from Paul in Melbourne and one from Nick listening live, streaming live in Tipton in England. So shout-outs to you guys. Thanks for listening. Now let's get into the final part of our analysis of Dr. D'Adamo's blood type diet. After all that heavy science in the first part of the show, I think it's time to relax, let our hair down, for those of us who have hair, and have a bit of a laugh at Dr. D'Adamo's expense, because he really does deserve it. So first of all, I really would like to make an apology here on Reality Check, because in episode 5, I referred to Dr. D'Adamo as a douchebag. So I'd like to apologize most sincerely. I spoke there in haste without having all the facts because I confess I didn't actually know what a douchebag was. And so As a good skeptic, concerned about facts and evidence, I looked up the meaning of douchebag and I discovered that a douchebag is a bag for holding the fluid used in douching, that is, vaginal or rectal irrigation. So, knowing that now, I really must apologize because I see that douchebags actually do serve a useful function in this world. So, I would like to apologize most sincerely to all the douchebags out there for comparing you with Dr. D'Adamo. You douchebags are just doing your thing and serving a useful purpose in the world, which is more than can be said for Dr. D'Adamo. So, speaking of Dr. D'Adamo, what I wanted to do now is point out some of the more, how shall I put it, interesting passages from Dr. D'Adamo's book that really highlight how ignorant he is and what a mind-numbing experience it is to read him. First up, an example of his eloquent style. Here's a quote from the first chapter of Dr. D'Adamo's book. Given the amount of available research data, it is amazing that the effects of blood type on our health have not received the measure of attention that they deserve. But now I am prepared to make that information available, not just to my fellow scientists and colleagues in the medical community, but to you. Don't you just love the way he talks about my fellow scientists? Oh, excuse me. Sorry, listener. It's just that every time I read that passage, for some strange reason, I feel vomit rising into my mouth. Sorry. Anyway, so this kind of passage is a big red flag that indicates that what we're dealing with here is highly likely to be pseudoscience. The idea that he, one lone supposed genius, has made this amazing discovery that the rest of the world is ignoring, and he's decided, out of the goodness of his heart, to make this information available to you, the reader. Also note how he decided not to take the route of first publishing his supposed findings in a peer-reviewed scientific journal, but rather to simply put them in a book that's being marketed strenuously to the general public. I wonder why he chose that route. Well, now let's look at some other revealing quotes from the scintillating prose of Dr. D'Adamo. And believe me, his book is packed full of quotes as stupid as these ones. I'm just going to give you an illustrative sample. At one point in his fascinating discussion of lectins, he says this. Once the intact lectin protein settles somewhere in your body, it literally has a magnetic effect on the cells in that region. Wow! Really, Dr. D'Adamo? It literally has a magnetic effect? You really mean that? Well, let's see. There are three possible explanations for this statement. To literally have a magnetic effect, we'd need to have magnetically active substances, which are, basically, iron, nickel, or cobalt. Now, a lectin, which is a protein, doesn't contain any iron, nickel, or cobalt. So, maybe what Dr. D'Adamo is suggesting is that the carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen atoms in the lectin, as well as in the cells of the body, all spontaneously convert into iron, nickel, and cobalt atoms with magnetic properties and start to attract each other. Maybe some type of nuclear fusion occurs to leap up the periodic table from carbon with 6 protons in its nucleus to iron with 26. Now, that's never been observed or even posited by anyone in the history of science, But then again, as we've seen, Dr. Didamo is not averse to making bold statements. So maybe that's what he means. Then again, there is a second possibility, and that is that when Dr. Didamo says that lectins literally have a magnetic effect, he actually doesn't know what the word literally means. And then, of course, there is a third possibility, and that is that the good doctor would know what the word literally means if you actually sat him down and asked him, but these questions of semantics are so trivial, and frankly, who are we to question the eloquent prose that comes flowing from his fingertips when he sits down at his keyboard to churn out his latest best-selling book? I mean, please, how petty can we get? Well, we can get a little more petty because there is one other quote that I would really like to bring your attention to, dear listener, and that is this one. Blood is a force of nature, the élan vital that has sustained us since time immemorial. A single drop of blood, too small to see with the naked eye, contains the entire genetic code of a human being. The DNA blueprint is intact and replicated within us endlessly through our blood. Right, Dr. Didamo. Okay. I think that to anyone with a basic high school knowledge of biology, that sentence is unintelligible. The best you could say about it is that it's misleading. What has blood got to do with DNA replication? DNA is replicated when cells divide. That's got nothing to do with blood. And it's odd that of all the tissues and substances in our body that he could have mentioned when he wanted to talk about cells carrying our genetic code, Dr. Didamo chose to focus on blood. Because any other part of the body, the brain, the liver, the big toe, any other tissue has more DNA than blood. In fact, blood contains the least amount of DNA of any part of the body. Blood is about 55% plasma, which contains virtually no DNA. And it's about 45% red blood cells, which, guess what, also contain no DNA. In fact, red blood cells are the only cells in the human body that don't have a nucleus and therefore don't contain our body's DNA. Blood also contains platelets, which also contain no DNA. So the only cells in our blood that do have a nucleus and therefore our DNA are the white blood cells, which make up less than 1% of the volume of blood. Does Dr. Didamo realize this? Even if he does, somehow I suspect he just doesn't care. I mean, hello, who was on the New York Times bestseller list? Who? Yes, Dr. Didamo, you were Dr. Didamo. And far be it for me to suggest that something as trivial as truth or facts should get in the way of your book sales. And Dr. Didamo has certainly sold a lot of books. I mean, why be content to have just one best-selling book based on your crappy theories when you can multiply your earnings with sequels? So after the success of Eat Right for Your Type, published in 1996, the good doctor published Cook Right for Your Type in 99, and then Live Right for Your Type in 2001, and then in 2006, the scintillating Aging, Fight It with the Blood Type Diet. And not forgetting all the supplementary books just for the type O's or the A's or the B's or whatever. And then, of course, there's the Complete Blood Type Encyclopedia for handy reference to all the piles of scheisse that Dr. D'Adamo produces. And Dr. D'Adamo even has an easy-to-use website where you can buy lots of herbs and vitamins and supplements and diet shakes and even a marvelous product called Deflect Lectin Blocking Formula. It says on the pack, Deflect A provides anti-adhesive therapy to blood type A lectin-sensitive individuals by blocking the effects of dietary lectins before they cause damage. Wow, there's money well spent. And rarely will you come across a better example of that old adage, garbage in, garbage out. Well, actually, probably not so rarely, because out there in the world, there are lots and lots of people just like Dr. D'Adamo, who sell diets and supplements and so-called alternative medicines and therapies and wonder cures, all based on spurious or simply made-up claims. Unfortunately, Dr. D'Adamo is just one example of thousands out there. And he's not the worst by any means. The worst of them sell what they know are useless products to people with serious illnesses just to make a profit, not caring if their victims live or die. Now, I wouldn't put Dr. D'Adamo in that category. But still, I think that what he's doing is morally reprehensible because he has had it pointed out to him on numerous occasions that his theories are scientifically unsound. But he goes on putting himself out there as some kind of scientific expert and making the same claims. Why? Well, I guess because he's making a lot of money from it. And the consequences are that a lot of people are following diets that are not necessarily good for their health. The most common blood type is type O. That's estimated to be about 46% of the world's population. And according to Dr. D'Adamo's diet theory, they're supposed to eat a lot of meat and little grain. Now, that doesn't sound too healthy. Not healthy for the humans, and not too good for the animals being eaten either. Now, more seriously though, Dr. D'Adamo, throughout his books, makes numerous references to combating certain diseases using the blood type diet. He's even written specific books on how to fight diabetes and cardiovascular disease based on the diet. Now, I haven't read those books, but if the advice they give is based on his flawed theories, then one imagines that they can't do much good and may even make people worse off than they were to begin with. And I mean, diabetes and cardiovascular disease, they're not trivial diseases. They're both serious and potentially life-threatening. But perhaps the most reprehensible advice Dr. D'Adamo gives is concerning vaccines. Dr. D'Adamo says, and I quote, Type B children sometimes have severe neurological reactions to vaccinations. And he goes on to try to explain why type Bs react so badly to vaccines and posits that it's because vaccines cause the type B immune system to turn and attack its own tissues. He doesn't actually recommend that parents of type B children don't get them vaccinated, but one can easily imagine that statements like that would put a lot of parents off getting their kids vaccinated. And for what? For any good reason? No, just because, just something that Dr. D'Adamo made up to fill a few more pages of his book. Well, I could go on for hours and hours about all the stupid and ridiculous and irritating things that Dr. D'Adamo says. Well, in fact, I have gone on for hours, But I could easily continue for hours more, but I won't. I'll end our analysis here. And I didn't even get into Dr. Dedemo's amazingly insightful discussion of how blood type affects your personality. Now, there's some nice pseudoscience for you. But maybe in some future episode, we'll come back to that and look particularly at Japan, where the belief that blood type determines your personality, a kind of astrology based on blood types, is extremely popular. But that will all be another day. So what was the point of all this, this long and detailed investigation into the blood type diet that's now extended over 4 episodes? Well, partly it's just to debunk the blood type diet. I hope that everyone listening is now thoroughly convinced that it has no scientific legitimacy to it whatsoever. But also, I wanted to demonstrate how tricky and complicated it can be sometimes to deal with pseudoscience, especially pseudoscience that at first glance seems plausible to most educated readers. As skeptics, we get confronted with all kinds of extraordinary claims. Now, some you can immediately dismiss as obviously absurd. For example, one of my favorites in this category is the conspiracy theory that the world is run by an alien race of shape-shifting lizard people. This theory is espoused by one-time BBC sports presenter David Icke, who believes that certain powerful people, including George W. Bush and the British royal family, are actually these reptilian humanoids or reptoids in disguise. And, dear listener, you'd be surprised and depressed to find out that he actually has thousands of followers. Seriously. But anyway, claims like that are so ludicrous that they hardly warrant any serious investigation. And in fact, most of the people making those kind of claims are probably suffering from some certifiable psychiatric disorder. But claims on the other end of the spectrum that inhabit the borderlands where science meets pseudoscience, they are much harder to deal with and can't be dismissed out of hand. To find out if and how true they are, you actually have to do quite a lot of investigation and critical thinking. Now, I could have just dismissed Dr. Dedemo's blood type diet out of hand as having no scientific validity, but I wanted to demonstrate the type of research and reasoning that you really have to go through before you can do that. And hopefully putting these podcasts out there will also serve as a reference to other people who are interested in investigating Dr. Dedemo's claims. They won't have to reinvent the wheel, so to speak, as I will have done a lot of the groundwork for them. But at least that's it for Dr. Dedemo. This is the last we'll hear from him, right? This is it, right? That's it for Dr. Dedemo? Right? Well, yeah, for the time being it is, but I hate to tell you this, dear listener, but just last week I discovered that Dr. Dedemo now has a new book out. It's called, you ready for this? The Genotype Diet. And the blurb on his website says, "The Genotype Diet uses the new science of epigenetics, which shows how environmental factors, including diet, allow you to change your genetic destiny. You can change the way your genes are expressed, in the same way you can affect light in a room by turning a switch on or off." Oh God, no, please, no, a whole new field of pseudoscience opens up before us. They're like moles in a game of whack-a-mole. You knock one down and another one just pops straight up. But I think that here on Reality Check, we'll bury Dr. Dodomo for the time being. Be warned, though, it may not be the last you hear of him. Now, finally, before we get into a song, I just wanted to give you our email address if you have any questions or comments about what we've covered on the show, or maybe something you'd like us to cover. Please feel free to send us an email. The address is realitychecktony@gmail.com. That's realitychecktony, T-O-N-Y, @gmail.com. All right, let's listen to our final song, and when we come back, we'll get into this week's movie review.
Joy. Joy. 94.9.
Today is a wonderful day. With Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check with me, Tony Pittman, here on Joy 94.9. Also streaming live at joy.org.au and also available as a podcast to listen to anywhere in the world on your little pod. Now, the song you just heard there was To Be By Your Side by a singer originally from here in Victoria, Nick Cave. And it's from the soundtrack of the movie, which was called, in French, it was called Le Peuple Migrateur. And in English, I think it was called Winged Migration, about the migrating birds all around the world. Now, okay, let's move into the final section of our show, which is this week's movie review. And the film up for review this week is Encounters at the End of the World, the latest documentary by legendary German filmmaker Werner Herzog. Werner Herzog is one of Germany's most famous film directors and has been making films since the 1960s. He's probably most famous for the movie Fitzcarraldo from 1982, and more recently for the Christian Bale movie from 2007, Rescue Dawn. His previous documentary was the highly acclaimed Grizzly Man from 2005. Werner Herzog has always been obsessed by human beings living in extreme environments. The jungles of the Amazon or Laos, the wilds of Alaska, and in his latest documentary, Encounters at the End of the World, he takes us to maybe the most extreme environment of all, Antarctica. Herzog flies down to McMurdo Station, an American Antarctic Research Center in New Zealand Antarctic Territory, and which is actually the largest community in Antarctica. From there, he heads off to several other locations in the area, including a seal camp, a penguin camp, a diving station, and Mount Erebus, an active volcano almost 4,000 meters high. And they get up to the rim of the volcano, where he finds scientists doing their experiments. But Herzog makes it clear from the beginning of this movie, with his somehow charming German-accented monotone, that his film is not going to be about fluffy penguins, and that what he really wants to know is why a chimpanzee doesn't make use of inferior animals and straddle a goat and ride off into the sunset. Which has, of course, nothing to do with Antarctica. But then again, large sections of the film don't have much to do with Antarctica. The things and people that Herzog finds in Antarctica, more often than not, serve as a springboard for Herzog's musings about life, the universe, and everything. Now, one interesting thing about this documentary is that you get to see what it's actually like to go and visit Antarctica. I don't think I'd ever really seen a documentary before about traveling around Antarctica. I mean, here you see where the people live, you see how they get around, you see the wildlife, you see the volcano. And maybe the most interesting part is when he visits a team of divers who are exploring life in the Ross Sea, underneath the Ross Sea ice shelf. The water there is -2 degrees Celsius, and it's totally dark there for 6 months of the year, yet it's teeming with life. They find these long, tentacled, fast-moving starfish things, which actually look more like octopi, and strange, luminous jellyfish and other weird blobs that look like swimming lampshades or something, and heaps of other bizarre creatures, all living beneath the ice. The cinematography is beautiful. And the other part I really enjoyed is when he interviews a rather solitary and not very talkative scientist who's been living amongst and studying the penguins in Antarctica. And Herzog tells him, with his German monotone, "I read about gay penguins and I was wondering if you have homosexual penguins here." And then he asks, "Do penguins exhibit signs of insanity? I don't mean if they believe that they are Lenin or Napoleon Bonaparte, but whether sometimes they just go crazy and flap their little wings and they go off because they've just had enough of this colony." So one thing you can certainly say about Werner Herzog is that he's an original filmmaker, and his mind often works in original ways. So I can highly recommend this documentary. But don't go expecting a disciplined, focused examination of the nature of Antarctica. Encounters at the End of the World is a Werner Herzog documentary. So that means he just goes around interviewing odd people he finds in odd locations, and the topic of conversation can head off in the most unexpected directions and lead to much reflecting and philosophizing. So just go with the flow and enjoy what comes along for the ride. And that brings us to the end of the 7th episode of Reality Check on Joy 94.9. I hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to send any questions, comments, or feedback to realitychecktony@gmail.com. And remember to tune in at 1 o'clock next Tuesday for episode 8. Have a great week, everyone. See you next week.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.